You're listening to Lighthearted, the official podcast of the United States Lighthouse Society. My name is Jeremy Dontremont. Welcome. Today is March 31st, 2024, and this is episode 271 of Lighthearted. I'm going to go ahead and get right to today's interview. Our guest is Tony Ashton, who spent 22 years in the Coast Guard, including some time as a lighthouse keeper. Tony spent some years on an aids to navigation team that serviced lighthouses and other aids in District 1 in the northeastern U.S. He was also part of an inspection team for a while. He spent a few years as the keeper of the old Deer Island Light in Boston Harbor, a spark plug type lighthouse that no longer stands, and also at Plymouth or Gurnet Light in Massachusetts. Tony is also an accomplished model boat builder. This interview was facilitated by John Lopez of the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and I want to thank John for that. He also takes part in the interview. We visited Tony at his home in Rockport, Massachusetts a few weeks ago, so let's listen to our interview with Tony Ashton now. I'm in Rockport, Massachusetts at the home of Tony Ashton, who spent many years in the Coast Guard, did a lot of work that relates to lighthouses. We're going to talk about all that today. Also joining us is John Lopez. John serves as an environmental protection specialist in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and he's responsible for introducing me to Tony. So thank you so much, John. Thank you both for doing this today.
You're welcome.
So, Tony, I understand you're in the Coast Guard for how many years was it? I know it's 20-something years.
22.
22 years, yeah. When did you enlist?
1956.
That was a good year. It was the year I was born.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A lot of good things happened that year. So where did you grow up and what got you interested in the Coast Guard?
Well, my father was a surfman. He retired as a W-4 warrant bosun with 30 years service. So I grew up with the Coast Guard. And we're originally from a place called Charlevoix, Michigan, and Beaver Island, Michigan.
Lighthouses on Beaver Island.
Yeah, Beaver Island was my first home when it was just down the street from the Northern Lighthouse. Until the ninth grade of school, I was probably about 52 or so. My whole life was spent up in Wisconsin, Upper Michigan, and the Upper Peninsula, and so on and so forth. After that, my father was stationed on a buoy tender out of San Juan, Puerto Rico. From there, we went to South Carolina for the 11th and 12th grade of high school, and I met my wife.
Yeah.
Joined the service in the fall just after graduating at 17. So when I came in the Coast Guard, they had loads of different tests we had to take, mostly in boot camp, to figure out who you were and what you were and where you could fit in. After all the tests were taken and we're back in the barracks, everybody compared notes. And mostly the higher number, the better score was. I qualified for everything they had, and usually higher than most, except for one item that was, I believe, called PI. To me, that would be political influence, but I don't think it was.
PI. Hmm.
They explained it as... the higher the number, the closer you were to cracking up if you were, you know, taken prisoner or things like that.
Oh, geez.
And the lower the number was, the better. And I had, until I found out what it was, I had like a 15 and everybody else was up in the 50s.
Oh, so that was good that you had a low number.
Yeah.
So what rank did you achieve in the Coast Guard?
Master Chief Bosun Mate with a large A/large N after it. Aids to navigation. I went to school for 6 months.
Where was that?
That was in Groton.
Groton, Connecticut. Yeah. So you mentioned South Carolina. Tell me about your connection to the Sullivan's Island lifeboat station there, also the lighthouse there.
Well, actually, I explained to my wife that the new lighthouse that's there was new, you know, after I left, was a monument to my wife and I, because that station, when it was strictly a lifeboat station, it was run by my father. And the crew and myself knew that if we had a date in a car, we could park back by the paint bunker, which was very near where the lighthouse is now. And nobody could bother us, the state, the county, or the local law enforcement were not allowed on government property. That would only come into being when there was a boat call and they'd call my father to come to the station. I'd have to take my date and myself and get lost real quick. But my home of records in the service was that lifeboat station for 22 years.
But even though you did most of your work actually in New England, right?
Yeah, most of it was in New England.
Yeah. So you worked in Ace Navigation, as you said. And any particular visits you remember to some of the more isolated lighthouses and that kind of thing?
Part of my job at the district was being on the district inspector's team in anything that had anything to do with HDA navigation. I would go on those inspection tours, which were most of the lifeboat stations and the lighthouses. And Isle of Shoals had three men on it, and we flew in with a helicopter.
Yeah.
And I personally carried my share of the sand and the stone and the concrete to build the helicopter pad.
Ah.
That we brought up on the White Heath, the 133-foot buoy tender.
Yeah.
I was on. It was the first station I had with a new captain that was an inspector. And he kept coming over and asking me what I thought of the place all through the inspection. And I told him, I says, well, you may not realize it, but the way that you figure out how a station is doing is by the coffee. And I'm only on about my fourth cup, and I haven't quite made my decision yet. And let it go at that. And I gave him glowing reports because three guys kept the whole station spotless. And it was old, it was wooden, everything was painted and shined. And from there, we went to Boone Island. And Boone was the new station. Everything was stainless steel, no maintenance, the whole bit. And when I checked the 8N part out, I wasn't satisfied. When we first went into the place, the officer in charge, which was a first-class bosun mate, promptly told everybody, and there was an awful lot of brass, a full captain, to kindly take their shoes off before they came into the station.
Wow.
And I quickly got the guy aside and told him we could discuss it outside behind the barn if he didn't understand, but you weren't about to ask a full captain to take his shoes off. And it wasn't that well maintained as far as logbooks and equipment and so on and so forth. I couldn't make the captain understand that the first lighthouse, Isle of Shoals, was outstanding and this one was par, you know.
John, you wanted to ask him?
I would. Tony, could you please tell us what an average inspection of a light station was like? Could you walk us through your inspection? Did you go up in the tower? Did you look at the Fresnel lens? We always hear stories about how the brass had to be shining and there couldn't be any dust. Could you just walk us through your typical inspection?
Yeah, that you're correct on all points there on lighthouses. On lifeboat stations and lights that were on the beach I could drive to, I did my training thing. And I would go in a couple of months before the inspection and bring them up to snuff on all the paperwork and so on and so forth. And then in 2 months, I'd come back and inspect them. And the offshore, like Boone Island, I didn't train. But the spare parts, mainly the stuff to drive the light and the fog signal, were all important. And when they had old stuff that was burned out or something, just kicking around for no reason at all, or didn't have a spare, or things like that, then that got them bad marks for me. But, you know, like you say, we'd come on the station and check everything they had, the fog signal, the emergency generators, and the light, and whatever they had for breakdown light, and so on and so forth, to make sure they're in compliance. But there was a huge, maybe 2.5 foot long sheet of paper by 18 inches tall on the light stations that told them everything. And the main thing was when to turn the fog signal on. If you can't see this, you can't see that. If this is obscured or that is, turn the fog signal on.
John, you've been to Boone Island in recent years.
I have. It was a thrill of a lifetime. It was on a oil spill investigation deployment through MSD Portsmouth. So I had the honor of flying out, landing. We did our thing, and we collected some oil samples. Apparently, we had heard from one of your previous podcasts where you interviewed the keeper. So we found out his name. We tracked him down. You mentioned he was from Georgia. So we did an internet search, and our MST1 made a phone call and interviewed him. We wanted to know how the oil got there, if he had anything to do with it. And as you pointed out in your podcast, he was air evacuated during the storm of 78. So people have to leave in a hurry. So we just surmised that was leftover heating oil. If that wasn't a thrill enough, we were told to bring overnight gear in case our helo was redirected to on a SAR case. We had to spend the night on Boone Island. We really wanted to, but unfortunately, they picked us up.
Yeah, I would comment on your trip out there with the helo, as I was surprised to find out that you were outfitted for the trip. You had a Gumby suit, and so on and so forth, because my comment on flying on the helos was every time we flew them to these places, all the crew had wetsuits and knives and crash helmets and a whole bit, and all we had was our dress uniform.
Wow. Speaking of helicopters, you posted something online about a time you did an inspection at Matinicus Rock. It's like the early 1970s, and you went there by helicopter.
We had fog, as once in a while happens down east.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's where they make it, I think.
That is real fog. We had fog, as once in a while happens down east.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's where they make it, I think.
That is real fog. We were flying above the fog, and all of a sudden you hear the motor and everything change, so you know they're going to land the thing. And we came down through the fog and down through the fog. And finally, we came down where we could see rocks and water. And the helicopter made a circle of the island. And on these trips, the chief yeoman of the inspectors, he was all the time with the captain and so on and so forth, he always got a set of headgear, so when we flew, he could listen to what the crew and were talking about. Well, he was getting real antsy as we got down and went around this island. And of course, none of us knew. We were just sitting there watching him, and he was nervous. And they came in and they landed the helicopter. And we asked them all, you know, what was all the excitement that you weren't sharing? Well, when they flew around the island, they found the boat ramp. So they're going up the boat ramp with the helicopter in the fog, and the pilot and the co-pilot were discussing on which side, left or right, was the radio beacon tower. And they chose the right one because... but,
Yeah. That could have got messy.
Yeah, real messy. Some of the times we landed the crewman, I don't know what they call him, but the guy that worked the door and everything, we'd be laying flat as they came down and looking under to make sure the wheels were landing on the helipads. And I remember one of them, they had one of the wheels was half on and half off the concrete.
But oof. Yeah, Matinicus Rock, that's out there. That's one of the most remote light stations. Yeah. So let's talk about your time as a lighthouse keeper. So you're a Deer Island light in Boston Harbor, which no longer exists. They took it down in 1982. And are we talking 1960s at this point?
Yeah, it was just after I was on the White Heath, so it would be 63 or so.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like? What was Deer Island light like?
Well, it was different, to say the least. And I can't remember the exact facts. There were four of us on the light, assigned to the light. I was the officer in charge. And we had compensatory leave because it was considered isolated duty within continental United States. And that amounted to you'd get a week off at a whack.
Was it 3 weeks on and a week off or something like that?
It was 4 or possibly 5 weeks when I first went on there for a week off. So it wasn't grand for my wife and my kids and so on and so forth. But I could, you know, telephone and stuff from there. The skipper I had on the White Heath, Donald Bangs, again, he became group commander, Point Allerton, right about the same time I went on that light. He thought a lot of me because I had done some really wild things for the couple of years I was on the White Heath.
What kind of wild things?
Oh, jumping buoys.
Okay.
It was too rough to hop a buoy, but I didn't want to come out tomorrow. You know, I would save the crew and do it today, and I would do it personally. Things like that. And my crew did a lot of, my buoy gang did a lot of wild things.
That's scary. Even in calm weather, the idea of that really scares me, jumping on a buoy.
Yeah. Well, in those days, it was electric, which were the special lead acid batteries, and it was also acetylene. And when you jumped, I jumped several times, the one up here off of Halibut Point.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember is it was a black buoy, and it was probably a 938. It was the biggest of the big. And when they go out, you jump the buoy, you open the top off of the thing to let it air out from the acetylene gas, and then you go ahead and try to repair it as is or strap a smaller tank onto it, and like a hot shot to keep it going till a big tender could come and work it.
Yeah.
But I've been royally seasick on those things. They're like this bucking bull that they have.
I was thinking of that. It's like being a rodeo rider.
Yeah, yeah. You don't know. They whip this way, that way. And you're nervous, you know, because what you're doing is dangerous. And you got the acetylene, which is
explosive.
Yeah, cross-eyed, it would blow.
Wow.
So I would crawl on the bottom of the buoy, heave, and then go back up and finish the job fine.
Oh, wow. That's a dedication. So how long were you stationed at Deer Island Lighthouse?
Probably 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it got better. I had a third-class engineman from Detroit who was very intelligent. We were all very young and did a lot of real crazy things. Because Donald Bangs was group commander, I could get most anything I wanted. So we dreamed up the idea that it might be advantageous on the light to have floodlights on the Deer Island side and on the channel side in case we had to get on or off at night. So they went along with that. And then we got a 16 cubic foot freezer, which meant we could buy milk and buy bread, you know, for a 2-week stay and freeze it and use it.
Yep.
Whereas before, when I went on there, meals were a box of Appian Way pizza mix. And they would make a pizza and eat that and watch TV, or a jar of ragu or something and a box of spaghetti.
Yeah.
That would be a meal. When we got the freezer and so on and so forth, I got a hold of my wife and got recipes, and we ordered roast beefs and all kinds of things like that. And it was nice that somebody in the crew always wanted to cook. So everybody else in the crew was so delighted that somebody wanted to cook that they would happily do all the dishes and so on and so forth. So it was a real working situation.
Mm-hmm.
But the floodlights, the ones towards the channel, were used for fishing because there were a lot of codfish and so on around the light.
Mm-hmm.
And we also got a clothes dryer, and those were out in the watch room. It was a wooden establishment, I guess, during the war with the submarine nuts and stuff. They had a watch station there.
Yeah.
The dryer was so situated in the wintertime that we could turn the dryer on, go out on deck, and there was a hatch to go down to the next deck below it, right there. And we'd be in a cubbyhole out of the wind. We'd have the dryer blowing on us to keep us warm.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the lights would draw the fish. And on the back of the light, my engineman, this guy from Detroit, I talked the group into getting a stereo record player, portable. And this was all new at that time. And the kid from Detroit was an engineman and nuts over cars and dragsters and everything. Behind the light, towards Deer Island Pumping Station, in the season, all the small boats would come out and anchor right there on the outgoing tide and fish for striped bass. So they'd be almost, you could almost walk ashore over the boats. So this instrument of mine got fiddling with the lights one afternoon, and I asked him what he was doing. He said, "Oh, just wait to see." Well, it got dark, and he got the stereo out, and he went out on deck, and he spread the speakers out and came inside. And when it was totally dark and all the boats were all parked out there, anchored, fishing, the smart ass, Benjamin turned on the two lights out there that shined on the boats and turned on the record player with a drag strip record, and it had a car winding up over here and going out over there. And when he did that, there was all kinds of commotion in the boats because here's a car going to run over them. And then they all realized what was happening. And it did total laughter.
Wow. I remember quite a few years ago, I interviewed an ex-coastie named John Baxter, who was stationed at Deer Island Light a bit after you were. It was later in the 60s. He said when new guys would show up there, they would tell him the place was haunted. And he said that it had a little bit of a tilt to it. And according to him, the officer in charge would put a cup of tea on the table, and the new guy wouldn't notice that it was slanted, but the cup of tea would gradually move across the table. He said, "That's the ghost doing that." Did you have any experience with anything like that?
Yeah, I smoked a pipe at the time. It was Carter Hall tobacco. It was a yellow can. I would take a can of this Carter Hall empty, and I would take the thing that would pop the lid up and put it inside and put the lid back on. And I would start it on the stairs and get it rolling. And it would roll, and the lid in there would off-speed it, and it would roll, and it would stop, and it would go, and it would make a hell of a noise coming down. And the second-class boatswain mate on watch the next deck up would come running down to find out what was going on. And then he'd be chewing the kids out about doing this, you know, it was going to wake me up, and I'm laying there in the bunk just trying not to shake by laughing. Well, we did that one. And another time, I'm the same guy. Everybody had something new for him. In the galley was a shower and the sink, and we did laundry there and everything else. And we had a faucet on the wall of potable water to drink and what have you. We had, that was special because we had a big cistern thing for everything else, water. Mm-hmm. And I rigged the whole thing up with the galley sink was one nozzle and two handles. And I had put saran wrap on the nozzle inside and screwed it down. So when the guy came down in the morning off of the midwatch to wash up at the sink, he would turn on the water on the sink and the shower would come on. And he would turn the water off and the shower would go off. And he was going back and forth and we're, you know, just paying attention, but not really. So finally he turned the water on and I hadn't planned it, but he turned the shower off and it busted the saran wrap and it poured water in the sink. But, you know, it was crazy stuff like that.
Yeah. That, it was a little monotonous, so you had to break that up.
Everybody had to watch. And
you had a 24-hour watch, right?
Oh, yeah, 24 hours, and kept a log on it and everything else. We had a time out there when the Graves light had a strobe on it. They were always testing new things, and they put a strobe on the Graves, and every 4 hours we were supposed to observe it and see what it looked like, or if we could see it, and what the weather was, and so on and so forth. So we would turn this report in once a month to the district. And we quickly learned that if we kept our regular log with the weather correct, we could always fudge this other one without having to worry about the timing and stuff. Because we knew if it said foggy in the log, you couldn't see the darn thing and so on.
Yeah.
Well, for some reason, I don't know what it was, but I called Graves Light about the middle of the month, and Emil Carey was the first class postmate on that one. And I was talking to him, and the subject came up about his strobe light. And we already had 2 weeks' worth of reports now all booked out on what the strobe light had been doing. Emil told me, he says, oh, we discontinued that the first of the month. So I almost sent in a whole month's worth of data that never happened.
Tony, when you were officer in charge of the light station, this would have been in the early 60s or so. What was life like? Did you have, you'd mentioned the stove and you mentioned the galley and all. Did you have modern appliances, or were they left over from years before? And you talk about food and cooking. How were stores taken on, and how often did you receive supplies?
Okay, supplies, particularly after we got the freezer, we always bought supplies from the same store in Winthrop. We would call in an order, and on payday, we received our mail at the prison.
This is Jeremy. I'm adding this comment later after the interview. Tony mentions the prison at Deer Island. It was the old Suffolk County Deer Island Prison, or Deer Island House of Correction, that closed down quite a few years ago, but the prison was still in operation when Tony was stationed at Deer Island Lighthouse.
One time, all the convicts over there, whatever they were called, they were all, didn't pay alimony or something, they were tame. But they all wore dungarees and chambray shirts, and that was my crew's uniform, and it was before crows on the arm and shields on the hand and all that. So one time the correctional officers over there captured my crewman, was going for the mail, thought he was a convict, and I had to bail him out. What was the other?
The quality of life aboard the light station, modern appliances, things like that.
We had a submarine cable, so we had power. We also had telephone. The galley had an electric stove. We had a washing machine with a wringer on it that we used. We got the dryer, so we no longer had to have a clothesline. There was a time, I don't remember which year it was winter time, and it was about zero weather, and we got weathered in, so to speak, having a dreadful cold, and we had two large tanks for diesel oil on the deck, but diesel oil was somewhat contaminated with water, so the engineer always had to keep opening up the line and getting the water out and clearing everything. And at this time, the real engineer or whoever was acting as an engineer was not aboard. I only had the fireman. And he went down and took the thing apart in this horrible freezing weather and broke something, one of the parts, one of the connections. So we were without heat. Mm. And that lasted for at least 3 days. And I had sent a message on it via the group to the district that we needed parts. So it went about 3 days with no heat. Mm. And finally, I sent another message, and all hell broke loose at the district level. Somebody had dropped the ball. We had a boat come out and give us a box of all kinds of parts, kindly give them back what we didn't need. Mm-hmm. And we were all set. But the way we handled that was we had our bunks, had a mattress and a pillow. We had a wool blanket, and we had a bedspread. And some of the bedspreads were god-awful, a tan type of thing, maybe for the Army or somebody, and some of them were blue. But we hung one of these bedspreads across the door to the galley, and that was all that was there. Everything else was freezing. And whoever had the watch stood the watch in the galley and had the oven on the stove to stay warm. So when it got cold, they'd open the oven up for a little bit, and then they'd close it so we wouldn't burn that out. And the rest of us hit the sack with fully clothed, with our foul weather gear and everything else, anything else we could get, and just stayed in bed. Yeah. And it lasted for 3 days. So, yeah, there were some weird times out there, but...
What did you have for heat normally?
It was oil heat. With radiators.
Okay.
With oil.
So let's talk about your time at Plymouth Light, also known as Gurnet Light. That was after Deer Island, right?
Yes. That was for 1 month.
Only for a month. Okay.
I was trying to get Plymouth Light while I was on Deer Island Light, and Donald Bangs was the group commander who thought a lot of me, and when I got off of Deer Island Light, I went to Plymouth Light, and that is out on the Gurnet. It's a, I don't know how long it is, but a long...
It's a few miles.
...of sand dunes. That was wonderful. I had, you know, a total of 4 children, all told, and 3 of them had muscular dystrophy over the years, and... But my wife would come down on the weekend to Powder Point, and I would take the Jeep Wagoneer and pick her up and the kids at the time and bring them out to the light. And they'd spend the day and have a wonderful time and everything else. And we lived at that time, we were living in a mobile home,
mm-hmm.
Trailer trash. Yes.
I live in one now, so don't call me trailer trash.
So the girl, single girl that lived next door with her parents, had come out on a weekend and met my seaman out there at the light. They ended up married and so on and so forth. But after about a month's time, Bangs had been replaced by Kenny Black. And Kenny Black came out to inspect the station. And Kenny Black, the whole time he was there, didn't agree with my thoughts at all, because he wanted to have all the valve covers and everything in the engine room and the compressors all chromed and souped up. And at the time, the Coast Guard was dreadfully poor. When we were all done inspecting and everything, Kenny asked me, what time did we eat? And I told him about 20 minutes after I delivered him back up to his car. Because we were on commuted rations, we bought our own chow, we were paid for it, but there was very limited amount, and so on and so forth. Well, very shortly after that, I got orders from the district to transfer to Base Boston to drive the buoy boat that I call the African Queen, the 52307 Delta wooden-hulled buoy boat. And I called Kenny and explained to him how hard I tried to get out there and could he do anything, and he said no, he couldn't. I didn't realize it. Who instigated this transfer?
Yeah, I was thinking. A lot of people listening might know who Ken Black was. A lot of people call him Mr. Lighthouse because he saved so many lenses and stuff like that.
He saved everything and was very intelligent about, you know, grabbing it before it went to the junkyard. Yeah.
And that became the main Lighthouse Museum. I understand you also build model boats, right?
I did, yes.
You did? Not present?
I'm not building them right now.
Okay. How far back does that go?
I was building boats in Puerto Rico.
When you were a kid?
Yeah, when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my father had been a mate on the Rio Mar, which was Ariol's boat on the Great Lakes, and was all... Dad knew all the different sailing rigs and everything else. So he was a great help starting me into what mm-hmm. was right and what was wrong.
Yeah. So what kind of models did you build?
Well, when we moved here, Margo wanted a schooner to go in the window. So I started doing models. And I got acquainted with the Cape Ann Model Shipbuilders Guild, which met at the DAV hall by the high school once a month. In that, I built models.
Mm-hmm.
And the big deal in model making supposedly is building from scratch, which is get a set of lines or plans and build the whole thing from that. Well, I went that far and I went it further. I went out and cut my own logs and machined my own stuff and so on and so forth and build them that way.
Wow.
But I also built kits and...
Yeah. So you also, besides doing full ships and boats of all kinds, you also did half models, right?
Oh, half models. I did repairs.
Yeah.
Anybody that has time and wants to make money, you can repair model ships.
For museums? Did you do that?
For anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't do any for museums, but I did one for the daughter of one of the mayors way back when of Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
And it was had wooden sails and so on and so forth. And
schooner, maybe?
Yeah, it was a schooner. And it was small, but I got handed a box full of parts. And one sail I had to make, and I made it out of sculpted clay that you form the thing in and you bake it in the oven for so long and then paint it whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And got the thing finished and gave it to the woman. And she said that she showed it to her mother and her sister, and they all broke down crying that, I don't know, father or grandfather had this on the mantle forever, and now it was all put together again. But I didn't make money in it. I charged her a meal for my wife and I over at Lobster Land for doing the job.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of, you mentioned your wife a few times. She was quite an artist, right? You showed me a couple of her paintings, including one of Deer Island Lighthouse, which is beautiful.
Yes. Her thing was art history and oil painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, she was really good from what you showed me. So I've got two final questions for you, Tony, and these are for bonus points. But also before we close down, I want to give John a chance to ask anything else he'd like to ask. But okay, so here's my next to last question. And you can answer this or not answer it, depending on how you feel about it. But do you have any thoughts about why we should bother saving lighthouses at this point?
Yes, they're historical monuments to what was. And it was the Lighthouse Service, but also the Coast Guard.
But as you said, lighthouses are such an important part of Coast Guard history and the Lighthouse Service. Yes. Before that. I think they're our memorial to all the people who lived, keepers and the people who built them and everything else. So, absolutely. So the last question I have is, and this is for extra bonus points, okay? What was your favorite thing or what's your favorite thing or things about all the years you spent in the Coast Guard?
Boy, you'd have to give me a break to try to even figure that one out. I enjoyed the whole thing. I mean, all the way from boot camp till I retired. I am embarrassed when somebody calls me Master Chief Ashton. And I'm just, a chief. The chief is a chief. And I guess once you're a chief, you're always a chief. But it was a great experience. I went from a designated bosun mate seaman to second class in a year and a half on that.
Mm-hmm.
And learned all the seagoing part of the world.
Yeah.
In the North Atlantic way, above and beyond Newfoundland.
Yeah.
And that was 5 weeks out and 5 weeks in. And the 5 weeks in, every third night we had the duty. Every day during the week we had to work.
Yeah.
And I think it all amounted to two-thirds of the time I was on the ship, period, the whole time I was there.
Yeah.
But I got off of that by agreeing to extend for 2 more years of my enlistment so I could go to the Aidsden Navigation School, Groton.
Mm-hmm.
And my chief at the time had come off a light ship and hated it. So when I put in for Aidsden Navigation School, I thought he would be displeased. But he said, no, it was fine. It didn't bother him. It was his personal feelings about being on a light ship. And
yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you had a lot of amazing experiences.
Oh, yes. I was always somewhere when something was happening. I was on a White Heath when the 707 jet with the birds went into the drink. And we picked up the tail section. had that, and made the newspapers. I was on Deer Island Light with a seaman when a, about a 600-foot ship, I don't know what the name of it was in the anchorage, and a storm came up. And the ship was all torn down for repair, so they didn't have radio or anything. And the kid came up to me and told me the ship was dragging anchor. So I checked that out, notified the group and everything. And there's a thing in the paper about that, too, on Lighthouse Save. And it went over to Long Island, and the guy laid it right up against the old dock on Long Island.
Wow. A lot of experiences.
Yeah, our time on the lighthouse when Edward O. Snow came out, the crew was hearing about this and how he was a flying Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And we were spark plugs sitting in the water. And so they called up Edward O.
Yeah, he lived in Winthrop.
Yes, and he invited himself out to the lighthouse. They came and checked with me, and I said, sure. Fine by me, but you got to clean everything spotless.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to come on a weekend, and he didn't. And the next weekend, he didn't. About the fourth weekend, we'd forgotten all about him.
And he showed up.
Crew says, hey, somebody's tying up to our mooring buoy, and they're waving at us. So it was Edward Rowe and his wife.
Anna Merle.
And
Yeah,
she was really neat.
I knew her pretty well. Yeah, he was one of my inspirations. He's the one of the big reasons I got into all this.
Well, Ken Black used to have a thing going in the Quincy paper with Edward Rowe. They would argue over all these points.
Well, yeah, Snow had a regular column in the Quincy Patriot Ledger. But Ken Black would take him around to the islands in Boston Harbor sometimes and stuff, yeah.
Tony, you may have answered this already, but your career has spanned a really unique period in time.
It did, yes.
There are not, I never imagined that I would be talking to a real lighthouse keeper, but here I am. Maybe hard to ask or answer, but out of all of your unique experiences, out of the times in your life, in your career, what's the most pleasant thing, if there's one thing you could point to? Was it an afternoon with your wife down at Gurnet Point? Was it anything like that that you could tell us? What's the one most enjoyable moment of your career?
Well, this has nothing to do with lighthouses or the Coast Guard. It was when my first son was born at home. And I and my wife handled the job. We had a policeman and a policewoman. Policewoman was heating water on the stove, and the policeman was taking his sidearm off and putting it on the dresser and putting it back on, staying busy. And my wife and I, we had the child, and the policewoman brought the boiling hot water in and dipped a washcloth in it, and it was too hot to handle. And I asked her, maybe it would be smart to let it cool off before you wash the baby. And she turned around and looked at the baby and said it was a boy, and I stepped in that bucket of hot water. So that was the biggest thing that I can think of right offhand.
Yeah, it's hard to beat the birth of your son in your home. Yeah, but you've had a lot of great moments in your life and in the Coast Guard. So, Tony, this is fantastic. I really appreciate you spending this time. Thank you for hosting us in your home here in Rockport. And John, again, thank you for facilitating this, making it happen. Really appreciate that. So again, thank you so much, Tony. Maybe we can do it again sometime. There's a lot more to talk about, I'm sure.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have time with you on this.
Thanks again to Tony Ashton, as well as John Lopez, for making the interview possible. I feel that it's so important to preserve the memories of people like Tony Ashton, who were the backbone of this country's aids to navigation system for so many years. In general, the Coast Guard personnel who have worked at lighthouses and in the aids to navigation field don't get the publicity that the old keepers of the lighthouse service got, but they are a very important part of our history. Be sure to check out uslhs.org to learn more about tours, the passport program, preservation grants, the quarterly journal, and all the other things the U.S. Lighthouse Society offers. Remember that memberships and donations help to support this podcast. Next week, we'll be talking with Edward Peppett of the Association of Lighthouse Keepers, who is a podcast host and author. Until next week, to all our regular listeners and our new ones, thanks so much for listening, and keep a good light.